This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Eleonora Sanfilippo is Professor of Macroeconomics at the University of Cassino in Italy. She was previously a research fellow in the history of economic thought at the University of Rome La Sapienza, and continues to teach the history of economic doctrines at the John Cabot University in Rome. Her research interests are mainly related to the history and methods of economic analysis, and in particular to the questions of period analysis, time, and equilibrium in Keynes's model. Her recent paper in the Review of Political Economy clearly addresses all three of these topics, which are very close to my heart too. So it's a pleasure to welcome you here this evening, Eleonora, and I'm greatly looking forward to hearing your presentation of your paper.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Okay. I was kindly invited here by Dr. Hayes to present my paper on the use of the notions of short period and long period in macroeconomics, a paper which has recently been published in the Review of Political Economy, as Mark said, in July 2011. This publication represents a further development of a research that I started many years ago, at the time when I wrote my PhD thesis in 2000 on the notion of equilibrium in Keynes' general theory. The aim of the paper is to show that the meaning of the concepts of short period and long period is often unclear and may be seriously misleading when applied to macroeconomic analysis. What seems particularly difficult to grasp is the exact content to be given to them, as well as the analytical assumptions underlying them. One of the main problems, according to me, seems to lie in the fact that the meanings attributed to these methodological tools change accordingly to the different macroeconomic models and approaches, making comparison between them very, very difficult. As is well known, in microeconomic analysis, both concepts refer to the equilibrium position of a firm or industry, and to put it in a very, very simple manner, the short period is usually defined as a context in which the productive capacity is given, and what can vary with the fluctuations in demand is the intensity of the use of this given capacity. While on the other end, the long period is usually a framework in which the productive capacity can change to adjust to variations in the level of demand. This distinction, as originally conceived by Marshall, was essentially linked to the length of time necessary for the adjustment of supply to demand conditions in each specific market. So my point is that in microeconomics, the meaning of short period and long period is clearly identified. And any scholar, but also any student, can refer to these concepts with enough confidence that no misunderstandings can arise. My fundamental point in the paper is that these definitions become much less clear and much more controversial when we move to macroeconomics. In order to show the ambiguities arising when the concepts of short period and long period are employed in an aggregate framework, I provide here, and I provided in the paper, two main evidences. One is given by the interpretative debate which took place in the 80s and 90s, aiming at establishing whether Keynes's general theory should be considered as a short or long period analysis of the aggregate level of output. The other evidence is given by the different uses, or I would say misuses, of these concepts that are currently made in macroeconomics textbooks. See, for example, the textbook by Stiglitz, Krugman and Wells, Lipsey and Crystal, Blanchard, various editions. I have worked on all these textbooks in the paper. Now let me start with a brief recollection of the debate. Although Keynes's general theory has been widely considered as a short period analysis, it is easy to detect in the literature two different types of short period interpretations of Keynes's model, which refer to two different contents or definitions of short period. One is the neoclassical interpretations of Keynes's model, which are by far the best known. Think, for example, to Modigliani 44, Klein 47, Mead 78. They impinge on what has been called by Langenfurt the imperfectionist view, which is based on the assumption that once given enough time to change variables like the wage level kept in the pound in the short period, the economic system necessarily tends in historical time towards an optimal long period equilibrium by means of automatic mechanisms. Now, from the perspective of the present paper, we include under this group the new Keynesian interpretations of Keynes's model. Think, for example, to Lindbeck as Nowhere 86 or Shapiro Stiglitz 1984. But we include also those interpretations that define Keynes's equilibrium, unemployment equilibrium, as a disequilibrium position. Think, for example, to Clower 1965, Barrow and Grossman 1976, or Malinvaux 1977. Why we put together all this kind of interpretation? Because all these contributions share the idea that unemployment emerges as a short period phenomenon due to the existence of various rigidities in the economic system. And they also share the implicit or explicit assumption that in the long period all these rigidities will disappear and the economy will naturally tend to a full employment level of output. A second kind of short period interpretations of Keynes's model is made by the post-Keynesian interpretations, which, referring to Marshall's original framework, consider the general theory as an application, or if you want, as an extension of the Marshallian short period to an aggregate framework. Think, for example, to Davidson 78, Asimakopoulos 89, Lim 1990. Differently from the neoclassical ones, these interpretations, the post-Keynesian interpretation, do not adhere to the view that unemployment will be necessarily reabsorbed in the long period. On the whole, we can say that the post-Keynesians do not attribute so much importance to the concept of long period. Beside the short period interpretations of Keynes's model, we find in the literature also a different interpretative approach taken by Itwell and Milgett in 1983, which associates Keynes's equilibrium with a long period position of classical type. Against this interpretation, you can find Garignani 1983. And finally, we should also mention other interpretations, for example, by Nell 1983, Bhattacharjaya 87, Carvalho 1990, Amadeo 1992, Park 1994, which extend the relevance of Keynes's theory to the long period, all grounding on textual and or analytical elements that are present, according to them, in the general theory. So the debate just recalled is, according to me, a particularly telling example and proof of the ambiguous meanings attributed to short and long period in macroeconomics, and also a proof of the difficulties of communication among different theoretical approaches in macroeconomics due to the lack of a common ground even at a purely semantic level. If we look also at the macroeconomics textbooks, it emerges that the show period is usually associated to a given quantity of capital, as in microeconomic analysis, and or to a rigidity of prices and wages. Very often, it is also identified with a situation in which a differential exists between actual and potential output, the latter being understood as a full employment and stable position. Sometimes, but not always, the show period is also meant to describe simply a situation of short duration in calendar time. If we look now at long period in macroeconomics, we can say that sometimes it is associated with the full flexibility of prices and wages, but strangely enough, also with the assumption of an unchanging capital, differently from the definition of the long period in microeconomics. And long periods refers to a context in which there is equality between the actual output and the given potential output. Think, for example, to the ASAD model. Sometimes it refers to a context of growth of potential GDP and changes in productive capacity. Think, for example, to growth models. In the macroeconomic test, sometimes they refer to growth model as long period model and models which are valid in the long period. Very often, but not always, the long period is identified with the achievement of a full employment position in which change is ruled out, provided that a sufficient but not univocally specified length of time is given to the self-adjusting mechanisms to operate. The list is not complete because we can also consider the neo-Ricardian models of growth, wherein the long period positions are not conceived as full employment positions, but simply as situations in which the productive capacity is adjusted to the level and composition of demand. It is possible, in my view, to reduce this variety of meanings basically to two different ways of conceiving the long period. One as a dynamic context characterized by changing capital, where some fundamental forces are at work and some fundamental tendencies can be detected, and the other as a final position, possessing some specific characteristics where there are no incentives to change or where opposite forces counterbalance. It seems to me quite evident, for example, that one possible source of ambiguity derives from the use of the same wording to refer to two different things. The gravitation process towards a final position and the final position itself. Obviously, in the former, the capital cannot be conceived as given, neither in quantity nor in form, during the gravitation process, while in the latter it is possible to assume a conditional given capital stock, since all changes have already happened. My opinion is that, beside what can be considered as a terminological confusion, there is also a conceptual ambiguity which relates to the distinction itself between short and long period. Two uses of these concepts, in fact, seem to me to be just opposite. One use in which the distinction is purely logical, and some analytical characteristics are supposed to distinguish the short from the long period without necessarily referring to a particular duration in historical time. The other use in which the distinction is instead chronological, in the sense that a specific length in terms of calendar time is attributed respectively to the short and long period, and it is with the mere passing of time that the system goes from the former to the latter. Now, in the paper, I also suggest two possible explanations for the ambiguities arising when the distinction between short run and long run is employed in macroeconomics. One explanation has to do with the fact that these tools were originally introduced by Marshall at the micro level of the analysis and cannot easily be extended to a macroeconomic context of the analysis. Another explanation seems to derive from the habit, which Keynes firstly criticized, of identifying the long period with an optimal position. Let me examine first the difficulties arising in the application to aggregate models of methodological tools invented for the partial equilibrium analysis. Now, in the case of a single firm or industry, the assumption of a given productive capacity takes on a definite, a concrete meaning, and the short period as a logical device can also have a definite chronological duration, think, for example, to the fish market in Marshall. But on the aggregate level, you can still apply a logical short period, but it is far more difficult to give it a content in terms of historical time. 1 year can be a short period for some industries and a very long period for some others, in which the physical capital can be far more easily adjusted over a span of the year. As far as the second explanation is concerned, it was Keynes himself who, in the preparatory works of the general theory, criticized as a source of confusion the erroneous identification between the long period and optimal positions. Keynes wrote, "There is no reason to suppose that positions of long period equilibrium have an inherent tendency or likelihood to be positions of optimum output." Let me now clarify Keynes's method by recalling this fundamental and well-known passage of the general theory. Keynes wrote in chapter 18 of the general theory, "We take as given the existing skill and quantity of available labor, the existing quality and quantity of available equipment, the existing technique, the degree of competition, the tastes and habits of the consumer, the disutility of different intensities of labor, and of the activities of supervision and organization, as well as the social structure, including the forces other than our variables set forth below, which determine the distribution of the national income." Now, it is fundamentally on the basis of this passage that the general theory has been generally interpreted as a short period model. My claim is that applying the distinction between short and long period to the interpretation of Keynes's method of analysis proves not particularly useful, and on the contrary, a source of misunderstanding. Now, I do not deny that the hypothesis of a given productive capacity is used by Keynes, nor that the general theory is mostly built on this assumption, obviously. The idea that I suggest is that this assumption should not be linked to the traditional distinction between short and long period analysis at the disaggregate level, but on the contrary, should be considered simply as an application of the ceteris paribus method, that is, as a logical device to cope with continuous changes taking place in economic reality. This is why, in Keynes's model, the assumption of fixed plans does not seem linked in any significant way to the length in historical time of the period considered in the analysis. The lack of this link can be attributed to the awareness by Keynes of the crucial role played by fundamental uncertainty in the economy and to the need to take this element into account at both the analytical and methodological levels. The difficulties related to the existence of several meanings attributed to the long period and to its distinction from the short period are still there in modern macroeconomics literature. In the neoclassical interpretations of Keynes's model, the long period is simply a context in which the rigidities are relaxed and unemployment absorbed, while the level of capital is still given in the economic system. In the neoclassical theory of growth, on the other hand, the long period is a position of full equilibrium, both of labor and capital, towards which the system tends if enough time is given to the adjustment mechanisms to operate. In the post-Keynesian approach, the traditional concept of long period, intended as a gravitation center, is rejected in favor of an analysis of structural dynamics, in which the effects of changes in the level of capital are fully considered, but the introduction of the uncertainty a la Keynes makes indeterminate the final point the system will reach in its evolution through time. Think, for example, to the open system of Vittoria Chick, for example. In the Sraffian or neo-Ricardian approach, the long period position is derived from the classical theory and considered as a point of attraction for the system in real time, even though full employment is not at all guaranteed. Finally, we can just mention the rational expectations approach a la Lucas, where the short period is simply identified with a contest in which people do not revise their expectations, while the long period is a context in which, thanks to the revision process, economic agents are able to capture the underlying structure of the economy, which basically coincides with the Varesian equilibrium framework. Now, my provocative suggestion in the paper is, do not apply this distinction in macroeconomics, where it is a source of confusion and misunderstanding, but use, on the other hand, the ceteris paribus method, where the given factors, independent and dependent variables, are made explicit in each model in use according to the specific quesitum of the analysis. This is exactly what Keynes did in his general theory, where he never made reference to the distinction invented by his master, Marshall. We may guess because he was fully aware of the difficulties arising when it is applied to models and contexts other than those assumed by Marshall himself. In his biographical essay on Marshall, Keynes referring to short and long period concepts, wrote, "All these are path-breaking ideas which no one who wants to think clearly can do without. Nevertheless, this is the quarter in which, in my opinion, the Marshall analysis is least complete and satisfactory, and where there remains most to do. I hope that my discussion reveals just how well-founded this observation by Keynes eventually proved to be." Now let me finally spend few words on the relevance of this question, which is not limited, in my opinion, to a methodological and or history of ideas perspective, but to a more substantial issue. As Kregel, in 1983 contribution, rightly pointed out, the controversial point over which the discussion about short period and long period equilibria turns around is the general validity of Keynes's representation of the functioning of the economic system. Kregel wrote very clearly, "It is often said that if Keynes's theory is taken out of the short period and made into long period theory, then his approach would be the same as that of the orthodox." But Keynes's theory is not short period in this sense of the term, continues Kregel. "It is not limited to a period of time so short that the capital stock cannot change. Rather, it attempts to avoid analyzing everything at once by applying a method which identifies a single aspect of the broader whole for analysis. So the capital stock is not assumed unchanged over actual time. Rather, any changes in it are left to one side to be considered later." Keynes seemed perfectly aware of this intimate connection linking the distinction between the short period and long period analysis and the question of the self-adjusting nature of the economic system. Let me quote from Keynes himself, who wrote in a preliminary draft of the general theory, "Is the distinction between the monetary economy and the real wage economy partly the same as that between short period economics and long period economics, the fundamental assumption of the real wage economy being one which is in fact satisfied in the long period?" The answer, wrote Keynes, to this question is complicated by the doubt as to just what we mean in this context by long period equilibrium, a matter which Marshall has not explicitly settled for us. Same story for modern microeconomics, since again the big debating question on the ground is, are modern market economies self-adjusting? They are, and we have just to wait sufficient time, or they are not? This is the problem. This is why I think a deeper analysis of the methodological tools applied in the models currently used in macroeconomics, including, for example, a deeper understanding of the assumptions on expectations and the revision process towards equilibrium is work to be done. I can stop here. Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks. Many thanks.
Very lucid and very timely.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, I am delighted to have the opportunity to discuss this paper with Eleonora, which to my mind addresses a key issue at the heart of the interpretation of the general theory, and therefore, for my money, an issue central to the prospect of reclaiming macroeconomics from the new consensus, however remote that prospect may be. It is such a pleasure to find someone who even understands the questions, even if we have reached slightly different answers, as I will explain. Let me begin by identifying the common ground between us. Modern macroeconomic textbooks ride indeed roughshod over Marshall's classic distinction between periods, and they redefine the difference between the short and the long period simply in terms of wage and price flexibility. And there is a strong association in these texts between the long run, in which relative prices are flexible and full employment is in equilibrium, and in turn with there is a strong association in turn with the optimal or natural rates of output, employment, interest, and so on. And I note that in a recent or slightly more recent textbook by Carlin and Soskis, that they follow Blanchard in using the term medium run,
yes,
to distinguish price flexibility from capital stock adjustment in the long run. It seems to me that the steady state growth paths of the solo growth model are no more really than a dynamic version of the Pigovian stationary state, achieved by expressing the capital stock in intensive form per effective worker, so that in those terms capital stock is, there are no more dynamics, it's a static long period end position, even though we have growth going on. But Keynes, by contrast, separated the long period adjustment of the capital stock to the state of expected demand on the one hand, from, on the other hand, the optimality of that state of expectation. And this in turn reflects in Keynes the substitution of the principle of effective demand in the place of the optimal allocation of resources as the appropriate concept of general equilibrium in a monetary economy. I think that's what the principle of effective demand is all about, and that's why it's there, chapter 3, right at the very beginning. And of course, those who read the general theory know that the principle of effective demand assumes flexible relative prices in the short period, or short run, whatever you want to call it. I'll come to that. So that the textbook distinction indeed misrepresents Keynes's own approach. And the roots of this, I suppose, lie in the fixed price, fixed wage analysis of Hansen and Samuelson, which, however well-intentioned, has led us well away from Keynes. Eleonora also recognises that Marshall struggled with his own distinction, and in particular with his wish to link the logical convergence from short to long period equilibrium with a real process in historical time that you could observe, at least in principle. And she notes, she's already noted, that Keynes himself expressed how he was dissatisfied with his master's treatment of time, and I think you've rightly indicated that that's where Keynes hoped to make his biggest contribution, I think. And then when we come to the crunch here, you make the vital point, and I think this is central, that different industries and firms have different production periods, so that a distinction which makes sense at the micro level, at the very least, loses precision when you apply it to the aggregate. So her conclusion is that it's best to abandon Marshall's periods and stick to the cateris paribus assumption alone, making clear what is to be considered a variable and what is to be left out of account in any particular analysis. And rather than short periods, I think you prefer short chains of logic,
exactly.
That is.
Exactly.
Where I think you're following Alessandro Roncaglia. And you argue that this was Keynes's method. So much for the areas of agreement, which is very wide. And there's a lot to be said for the view that when a particular usage has become corrupt or tendentious, that it should be best abandoned. I could say the same about terms like natural rates, rational behaviour, rational expectation, and indeed general equilibrium. We are imprisoned by words. And even in English, there are fewer words available than the meanings economists make them carry. Nevertheless, there is a risk that we end up sitting in silence for lack of unambiguous words, and that we lose continuity with expressions of, or past expressions of thought. And you could argue, I might argue, that the dominance of mainstream economics has partly been achieved by the sequestration of language and the dismissal of methodology and the history of economic thought as no longer relevant for that very reason. The end of history, the end of economic thought. But where I differ from Eleonora, and this won't amaze you, I'm sure, is over my interpretation of Keynes's own use of periods. Alas, alas. Though we're not very far apart. I think Keynes's use of the short period as an aggregate macroeconomic concept was correctly executed. So Eleonora claims that Keynes abandoned the Marshallian approach in order to make progress. Rather, I consider that Keynes perfected it, or refined it at any rate, redefining rather than abandoning the meaning of the periods. I certainly accept that he could helpfully have been a lot more explicit about this. The warrant for my reading is my underlying methodological assumption that he was a competent theorist and that he did not make claims that he could not justify, at least in his own mind, even if conveying that has proved much more difficult than he might have thought. So where does the key difference of interpretation lie? In my view, following Joan Robinson for once, the periods are best understood as adjectives rather than substantives. And furthermore, there's an important distinction between period and term. in the general theory. So short period equilibrium, where short period's an adjective, refers to a quantum unit or point of time, which is Keynes's day, as he defines it in chapter 5. And it does not refer to a short interval of time. I think that is my central, most fundamental point, that the sense in which Keynes's theory is a short period theory is that it's struck at a point in time.
Instantaneous, practically.
Yeah.
Yes.
To all intents and purposes, a static analysis.
Yes.
Though he allows for the fact that, I mean, obviously, decisions are made in reality. Therefore, there has to be a minimum unit of time when those decisions are made. But they're all made simultaneously, if you like.
Yes.
Long period equilibrium, then, again, emphasis on the adjective long period, is then reached in theory over an interval of historical time. And that interval is the macroeconomic period of production, which he defines in the somewhat neglected chapter 20. And that period of production, I would argue, corresponds to the horizon of short-term expectation. So that means that long-period equilibrium is a short-term phenomenon, if you can get your head around that. I think there is something in common here with Mansukh Park's approach. He may deny it, but as I understood it when you described it to this seminar in March, both short and long period equilibrium are contingent on a given state of expectation, specifically the set of price expectations that govern the production decision, and which Keynes denotes as short-term expectations. Short-term expectation is itself a function of the set of long-term expectations that govern the investment decision. And because one depends on the other, that is why, in practice, long-period equilibrium may never be reached, as long-term expectations shift, affecting short-term expectations, and therefore shifting the long-period equilibrium position that corresponds
to that particular today. Day, yes.
Even though we're not at it, it's out there somewhere, but that long-period equilibrium can jump about depending on changes in confidence and all those psychological variables. It has no foundation in the neoclassical fundamentals. They are there in Keynes's theory as part of the givens, but there is this extra dimension that the state of expectation is an independent variable in its own right. So I think Keynes does link his analysis to historical time. For him, the short period is related to the present. It isn't actually the present, it's related to the present. So that he can validly claim that his theory does explain the level of employment at any time as being in equilibrium, which is what he says it is. And this connection of the short period with the present stands in contrast with Marshall's 6 months or a year, as he thinks in the principles, isn't it? And furthermore, the interval over which Keynes's long period is reached, if ever, by the dynamic oscillatory process, which he describes in three places in the general theory. This is no longer this period of time until you might reach that long period equilibrium is probably no longer than Marshall's 6 months or a year, because it's a question of how long it takes to produce capital goods in order to bring employment up to the level, to change the level of production to match a change in expectation. So the long period is actually, or the process over which the long period is reached in a given state of expectation, which never happens, is actually quite short. What this process is about is not capital saturation. It's not a question of reaching the classical stationary state where the marginal product of capital has reached zero. Stocks of liquid and working capital may reach their optimal level in that sense in relation to production requirements. But Keynes's long period position doesn't mean that long-term assets are no longer being produced. In fact, quite the contrary, investment is continuing, even in Keynes's long period equilibrium. And it was precisely this point that Pigou seized upon in his first review of the general theory, saying that Keynes had got it all wrong, you know, and that he was being totally inconsistent in constructing, how did he put it? A long period theory where there was still investment going on, or words to that effect. So I think the reason that the long period is there in the general theory is for theoretical completeness. I mean, it's necessary part or consequence of his analysis, but it's not something that he dwells on, as Asimakopoulos and other people pointed out. It's far more important for Keynes that today's short period equilibrium can shift discontinuously from day to day. Far more important than the possibility that it may converge smoothly to a long period position if nothing changes. So you may ask how short period equilibrium is to be reached if it is for all practical purposes instantaneous. And for a full answer, I shall have to refer you to earlier seminars and my recent working paper on short-term expectation, which is also forthcoming in ROPE, in the Review of Political Economy. But in brief, I would say that production price expectations, that's short-term expectations in Keynes's terms, are determined in forward markets, and that the principle of affected demand is itself a theory of the determination of the state of short-term expectation by supply and demand. But to say more would take us too far from our current subject, and I mustn't abuse the chair any more than I am already doing. So to conclude, I can accept the case for dropping the distinction between periods on grounds of ambiguity. Absolutely. Indeed, Keynes's own references to the periods in the general theory are largely oblique rather than explicit. But what I want to retain is the element of continuity with Marshall's thought, and also Keynes's claim to offer a precise scientific theory which explains variables such as income and employment in real time, or historical time. That being the case, this means we still have some way to go before a consensus is reached on the nature of equilibrium in the general theory, by which I mean a consensus which does Keynes justice. But I do think that this paper that Eleonora has presented is a very helpful step in that direction.